On behalf of Ted Gerber, who's the chair of CRECA, my name is Yulai Shamiloglu. Most of you know me as chair of the Central Asian Studies program. And so it's a pleasure to introduce our speaker, but before I do that, I should remember, which sometimes I forget to do, to remind you that there are various calendars of CRECA events. Most of our events take place at Thursday at 4 p.m. And next week, so September 18th at 4 p.m., there will be a survey of Thracian village music in Bulgaria, and this is by Kabila. This is actually a band, it's going to be more like a musical performance and so on. And so I apologize in advance, I'll be on a plane to DC, so I won't be there, but I'm sure it's going to be great. Please, you know, if you don't have a copy of the calendar, pick one up. And if you are not on any CRECA mailing list, I'm sure Jennifer Tischler would be very, very happy to have your email. Now, it's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker. He's Russell Zanka, who's an associate professor of anthropology at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. Russell did his BA at Hunter College of the City of New York and his MA and PhD in anthropology at the University of Illinois. And my association with Russell goes back to when he was a CIC visiting scholar. So if there are some of you who are graduate students and decide that, you know, occasionally you need some, you know, a year, it would be nice to be in Michigan or Chicago or for some reason Indiana or something, you can apply to the CIC and get a visiting fellowship and actually go to another campus supported by that. And so we were very fortunate to have Russell here, and it was a great pleasure to work with him. And so I've known him as a student, as somebody who sat in then as a visitor on his exams. I've known him as a scholar in our field, and I'm very happy to consider him a very active colleague in the field. So Russell's specializations include the cultural anthropology of Eurasia, particularly Central Asia, emphasizing rural economy, political systems, religion, labor, migration, cuisine, and social trends. Some of us still remember the great talk he gave about foodways in Central Asia, and we'd have to have him back for something like that again. And he also gave a really wonderful talk at the summer's workshop on Islam. Most recently, he has edited, together with Jeff Sahadeo, a book published by IU Press, Everyday Life in Central Asia. And he's also author of a book that is in print, about to come out, Big Cotton Plantations, Uzbekistan After Socialism. And he also has works in progress on the historical and contemporary dimensions of Central Asia and Farming for the State, the Oral and the Written of Stalinist Collectivization in Uzbekistan. So without any further ado, I'd like to present Russell Zanka, who will be addressing the failures of independence in Central Asia.
Well, thank you very much, Yulai. Thanks to everybody from CRECA for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here again. Thanks to all of you for coming out today. I will say that this stuff I'm working on now is kind of new for me, and I'm very interested in it, but I got a ways to go, I think, before I have a more sort of fully developed piece. So I hope you guys won't mind being a little bit of guinea pigs for me today, as it were. But I do hope it'll generate some discussion, and I think I'll leave plenty of time so that we can have questions and answers. What I wanted to say is that, yeah, I mean, you may have noticed on the flyer that it said failure, but of course I don't think independence has been a failure in Central Asia, because obviously the countries are still there. The title is Failures, and what I want to emphasize today are all the things that haven't gone particularly well in Central Asia for the past 20 years. Got very interested in this topic, I mean, because back in the early 90s, everyone was talking about the transition, whether it was East Central Europe or the countries of the former Soviet Union. And although we always date the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union to 1991, of course, all of you know that really this is about 20 years now. I mean, really it was 88, 89 when the major changes were happening throughout not only East Central Europe, but also the Soviet Union. So it's almost like an anniversary. So I want to revisit this topic. And I noticed recently that there's an awful lot of interest in revisiting this whole notion of what's happened with these transitions. Okay, well, more than 15 years ago, many experts reckoned that countries of formerly Soviet Central Asia would bloom in their full political independence. Of course, I won't mention any of them by name. But by the same token, there were plenty of experts who also knew that there were going to be major problems with independence for these countries, to be fair. Analysts and scholars predicted that these states would develop as robust and prosperous entities with an unprecedented degree of participation from sectors of society long oppressed within the Soviet system. Simply put, this hasn't happened, for the most part. And the fact is that most of these countries have become politically and economically retrogressive since the collapse of communism. The purpose of this talk is to describe and analyze some of the obvious and not so obvious reasons for the failures of independence in Central Asia, especially democratic participation, economic development, and regional cooperation. It is this anthropologist's contention that late Cold War predictions suffered from vast unfamiliarity with regional culture, and that U.S. foreign policy's influence will have only a marginal or symbolic role in terms of pressuring Central Asians to become more democratic and tolerant in the near term, mainly because of inconsistent messages toward authoritarianism and state brutality. In discussing the failures of independence, I wish to stress that Central Asia has not become a failure or a set of failed states, but that the failures I am going to address greatly thwart Central Asians from improving in their human potential to live more freely and with a higher standard of living than was possible under the authoritarian socialism of yesteryear. In short, I identify the following factors as being a part of the national failures: unwillingness to break with Soviet patterns of rule, lack of political pluralism, severe restrictions on economic pursuits, the use of nationalism only to benefit elites, the use of natural resources and agriculture solely for elites, the virtual absence of regional cooperation and integration, state violence toward people who protest and try to form oppositional movements, and lastly, inconsistent Western relations that try to balance concerns with religious extremism and human rights. Well, of course, there are many others, but those are some that I'm going to talk about today. The term transitology is one of those from academia that's pretty awful, and it became a part of Eurasian studies within the social sciences by the early 1990s. As a quasi-field emerging from political studies within Latin America, Africa, and Southern Europe, it engaged mainly economists and political scientists at first, who felt that the concept of transition was reasonable enough since communist collapse could not be replaced exactly by communism again. Scholars, being inherently varied and fractious by nature, never really agreed on what transition meant or if the concept would hold water, being premised on the principles that authoritarian structures will give way to increasingly democratic ones, including competition in pursuit of political office, and that people would be freer to pursue their own self-interests within market economies. Am I loud enough here?
A little louder.
I don't know. Nothing invited more criticism by the mid-1990s than this concept, because many newly independent Eurasian states seem to have regressed economically and politically a few years after the founding of new nation states, including those in the Caucasus and especially Central Asia. The criticism stemmed in large part from young researchers who began working in Eurasia shortly after Soviet disintegration, and who were able to see firsthand that whatever the transitions might lead to, they certainly had gotten many Eurasian people off on very rocky and unattractive paths. Furthermore, Western scholars, who now have the opportunity to travel widely and spend considerable time with rural Central Asians, understood that many Central Asians both admired the accidental independence of their homelands while also lamenting what they feared they were losing with the socioeconomic stability of patterning that characterized Soviet life. In sum, the transitions did not appear terribly positive because the new states actually were not promoting popular dynamism and plurality, which ipso facto are the only conditions one would think to transit toward. Frankly, because there really hasn't been much of a considered alternative to the modern and civilized political economy that favors a free market, pluralism, and watchdog news media, among other factors, how would it be possible for us to conceive of something that improves upon the post-war Euro-American nation-state beyond Western-style democracy? The result of making this kind of entity the model towards which any people, any political constituency really, must flock reflects part of a newer evolutionary understanding of progress. This isn't to say that that's necessarily a bad thing, but that it basically continues a retooled modernization theory. The Central Asian experience shows us that whether or not this model is the most desirable, there certainly seems to be no certainty that this will be the outcome. Moreover, its shortcomings become defined when the Western models send out very contradictory messages via policy in dealing with dictatorial regimes. Anthropologists privilege culture, of course, by which they mean people's habitual activities within social life and how people relate to their own local, regional, and national authority structures, individuals, and persons in power as a way of explaining political nature, in part. Political scientists often are more apt to look at factors such as capacity building, power consolidation, comparative transitional models, and institutional reform, or the institutions leaders willingly accept and tolerate that must become implemented in a particular manner for a given type of political system to develop. For the most part, like anthropologists, political scientists tend to focus on current conditions to explain transitional developments. Now, it isn't that anthropologists cannot understand the political scientists' perspectives, or that the political scientists think existing culture in no way makes a modern political system what it is. It is just that we work with very different models or paradigms of human organization. Anthropologists who enjoy the study of politics and power usually have approached research issues from the standpoint of culture change, one of the most significant and enduring of all topics covered by anthropology. Now, this, to be sure, should not mean that an anthropologist seeks an explanation that is deterministic vis-a-vis culture, but that ignoring this factor also makes it hard to explain why, for example, the Kyrgyz people accept American political workers who promote American-style democracy, whereas Uzbeks move quickly to shut down such organizations and their operatives in its country because of the perception of threat, unless one argues that it boils down to a very particular set of politicians at a particular historical juncture. Based on my fieldwork in both countries over several years, and my familiarity with local attitudes toward people in authority, whether political or familial, I would argue that the answer lies in combinations of these factors, that is, both the cultural and the contemporary political. Culture change remains relevant in our discipline today, just as it was more than a century ago, because anthropologists still encounter their objects of study in conditions of rapid movement and through external influences. Whereas the oldest studies of culture change dealt with peoples under conditions of colonialism, the newest studies, again political, examine changes of varying scale and in diverse locales where the idea of the nation or the state most broadly impinges on ordinary awareness. As a result, acts such as immigration or the emergent status of political sovereignty take away the familiarity of a person's world rapidly, which is what happened, I argue, in the post-Soviet Central Asia. In contemporary Central Asia, one cannot simply examine governance to best understand why, for example, Uzbekistan is a robust dictatorship and Kazakhstan is both authoritarian and somewhat freewheeling. One needs, in fact, to know much more about the ways in which ordinary people live their lives, organize their relationships, and relate to all manner of people in positions of political or state-level authority. Simple surveying of their attitudes and opinions cannot fulfill a fuller assessment of how they relate to local manifestations of organizational power or what they think they should be able to do about it. When we consider what students of the Soviet system throughout the social sciences missed in analyzing and predicting developments after independence in Central Asia, we're faced with, I think, essentially the fact that they neglected the enduring importance and steadfastness of Soviet approaches toward managing the relationship between governments and citizens. Simply, the overall embrace of things Western, as well as the strivings to be Western, to say nothing of political organizations and institutions, did not materialize to the extent many of us thought inevitable. Much of the blame here lies with the elites who inherited the legacy. Most of these people didn't intend to change business as usual in any substantive sense. Only in situations where a conscious effort existed to change the way people were to be governed have there been periods of what we may call liberalism in Central Asia, notably in Kyrgyzstan and to a much more limited extent in Kazakhstan. Frankly, the extent to which local post-communist Central Asian leaders have allowed and or embraced the representatives and organizations of foreign democracies or liberal capitalist nations, especially with people of the poorer or less powerful classes, largely determines the degree to which some political pluralism and some unregulated, albeit not illegal, economic activities exist in Central Asian countries. Concretely, what I mean there is that the extent to which a government, for example, allows a farmers' organization to work with farmers in a Central Asian country is usually a pretty good indication of what its level of tolerance is going to be. And when it tries to shut down those kinds of organizations or prevent those kinds of activities from happening, it's obviously kind of a failure of what you would consider anything going toward democratization. these decisions among leaders and governments probably have little to do with traditions of democracy per se, or cultural proclivities or habitual behavior. More likely, they reflect the desires of political leaders to establish a rule and an interrelationship with their constituencies that comprise either wide participation or a fixation on elite separatism and resource aggrandizement. It is in this sense, I think, that Valerie Bunce argues that the legacy of socialism matters when we consider how rapidly or slowly democratic change and economic reform materialize in Central Asia. Simply, there is usually strong concordance between a lack of democratic movement and highly controlled economic activity. Given the opportunity to opt for more pluralistic governments, the leaders who won whatever competition existed in the ferment of communism's collapse chose strong presidentialist governance over parliamentary or congressional bodies. Power vested in this manner accounts significantly for the dictators who now rule the region. While it may be a truism that Central Asians, by and large, revere and respect age in most manifestations of social life, this fact may favor the gerontocratic situations that we see extant. If there are not life terms for these presidents, then the sham elections they call every so often ensures their president for life ambitions. Nationalism, in combination with ethnic history, comes into play here given the titles leaders such as the late and unlamented Niyazov of Turkmenistan gave himself, just as it explains something about Karimov's association with Tamerlane, the Sohib Karom, or the grandfather of all Uzbeks. According to Bhavna Dave, a political scientist who works on Kazakhstan, one of the only measures of economic freedom in that country comes about through a very strict patron clientelism that allows for some freewheeling business activities and multi-billion dollar ventures as long as the representatives of leading entrepreneurial blocs maintain loyalty to the Nazarbayev government. This is pure crony capitalism. Successful business careers are tethered to support for the ruling elite, and in turn, these men exercise influence over the governing bodies by sponsoring only political parties loyal to the president. Those are her words. Why haven't Central Asians overthrown the kind of especially corrupt and brutal political regimes that emerged in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan in the mid-1990s? Where are the rebellions and revolutions necessary to put the kibosh on ex-communist dictators once and for all? To outsiders or visiting scholars, it would seem that people several times already have reached personal and collective breaking points with all manner of quality of life issues, to say nothing of the repressive fear that they have had to live with concerning political or religious outlooks, or simply because of some sort of outspokenness. Here too, however, the past practices intrude. Not only were Soviet state security forces maintained, but they were expanded and their powers increased. I myself wondered how it could be that many of these adults who had suffered tremendously under the Soviet system in various periods, only to live through a period of rising expectations in the late 1980s and then the unexpected but welcome era of unbridled nationalism and ethnic assertiveness of the early 1990s that accompanied political independence, could then allow themselves to be thrust back into repressive daily life situations. But these freer periods were very short. No generation grew up knowing only these liberal and nationalist years. Furthermore, it seems that many of us badly misjudged the effects of perestroika and glasnost on the ex-Soviet peoples. While we associate the years 1985 to 1990 with Gorbachev, or the Gorby phenomenon, non-intellectual and non-dissident ex-Soviet adults tend to view him as a bastard who wrecked a functioning country and order. He also was despised for the ways in which he took punitive financial action toward regions and republics that didn't fully comply with his own reformist agenda. To be clear, this does not necessarily mean that people were ideologically committed to the socialist system, but that the system gave them a known place to develop and live out their lives meaningfully. Since 2000, there have been firings on demonstrators in Kyrgyzstan's Jalalabad and Uzbekistan's Andijan. The latter, as many of you know, was a far more serious incident, that is, the one in Uzbekistan, Andijan, 2005. And it was an incident of mass repression of popular dissatisfaction with the Karimov regime. Still, in the wake of these events, popular responses that would serve as either peaceful or violent challenges to the authorities did not materialize. Why should this be so when it seems to those of us who have worked among poor and rural Central Asians, as well as among educated urban people, that the level of disgust with these regimes is very high? Personally, I mistakenly expected that the Andijan repression of 2005 would lead to the end of Karimov's leadership. But not only is this leader as firmly in power as ever, but Fergana Valley Uzbeks don't even want to discuss the horrors of Andijan. This is a remarkable failure of the state that has resulted in state leadership ruling even more powerfully and violently. People will not take action if they sense they can gain nothing from protesting and that the state will grind them up and that no one will really care. For a police state, this is, of course, an ultimate success, a retooled and strengthened state security apparatus specializing in intimidation and infiltration coupled with interrogational techniques and abusive treatment of those held in custody terrifies the population further. Abuses in these states cannot really occur when the governing and media organs never offer transparency, never let citizens know what's going on behind closed doors. Rather than working in concert to bring about what some American and Western specialists, to say nothing of many Central Asian intellectuals, imagined would be a Turkic Union or Confederacy back in the late 1980s, the new sovereign leaders focused their energies on consolidating national rule, which in part continued the Soviet style, that is, the Soviet approach to political consolidation based on the needs of a titular ethnic population. To be sure, within Central Asia and among Central Asians, there were debates about borders, primordial ethnic occupation of given areas, and rancor over whose people contributed more to regional high culture, etc. From their status as Union Republican leaders, and that also lends itself well, these issues, to Partha Chatterjee's contention that decolonizing territories became nationally minded, much as they discerned nation building should be from their respective colonial systems. But something else pertaining to nation building and nationalism in the Central Asian context must be entertained in looking at the failure of independence to generate a new participatory approach that would enhance popular social investment in the new country. And this strikes me as much more important in the wake of the USSR. First of all of us know that the Central Asians were not clamoring for independence in any way comparable, say, to the Baltic states, not as a mass society. While this doesn't mean that there weren't strong national and ethnic feelings extant among Central Asians, we really didn't see significant organized movements that coalesced around such political independence as an imperative. With the collapse of the old order, however, the old leaders of these new countries worked marginally with a broad swathe of members of the intelligentsia to craft nationalistic visions and ideologies that some outsiders at first thought a natural and vital step toward reclaiming ignored heritages and ethnic assertiveness, especially in contexts where indigenous populations felt slightly inferior to the Russocentric and Russophone system. However, rather than empowering those segments of their co-ethnic population that might have benefited economically from nationalist policies designed to strengthen sovereignty via thoughtful and creative development, by the attraction of foreign investment, nationalism failed a crucial test in attracting the population's deep mental investment in this kind of ideology. language, religion, the fine decorative and applied arts, education, science and technology, to say nothing of mass-based and mass-serving economic development, took a back seat to the power elite's great power projection via nationalism, the construction of heroic history, etc., all the while exploiting a nationalist ethos that benefited a small class of oligarchs and well-connected people who rapidly became wealthy through nepotism and corruption. In this sense, nationalist pride waned after the mid-1990s. It could have led to democratic changes, thus garnering greater personal investment in the nation, but it probably has achieved much the opposite. Discussions about the extent to which Kazakhs, Uzbeks, and Turkmen either favored the late communist order and economic system, or simply disliked the rapid rise of economic inequality with incipient capitalism, are, to some extent, beside the point. I still think these are reasonable positions to take, and the fieldwork of outsider anthropologists, meaning Western anthropologists, bears this out with sufficient evidence. That is, that people had a real stake in the Soviet system. However, to better answer why more liberal systems with greater popular participation have not arisen means that we have to first understand what really didn't change in terms of the socioeconomic and political orders of these various countries, all the while being cognizant of not treating them as monoliths. Only then can we attempt to answer why things have not turned out otherwise, because of an utter lack of transparency for the most part. Former communist leaders who went on to rule the Central Asian countries never really supported the Republic's oppositional and democratically minded liberal or democratic nationalists of the late Soviet era. To have done so would have cast them as true reformists to a degree, but these gaps existed before independence and grew much wider afterward. So there wasn't any strong alliance there. Central Asians themselves often tell foreign researchers in frustrated tones that their countries should be doing much better than they are, owing to the large reserves of natural resources, metals, minerals, and vital cash crop abundance, especially cotton. Environmental and agronomic hazards of these industries notwithstanding, the reason for the lack of development among the urban and rural working and peasant classes is that the state system continues to operate as an extractive one. Resource extractive systems feature governments that maintain total control combined with culturally circumscribed behavioral patterns about what is appropriate and inappropriate action in private and public life. Profit sharing is paid lip service, but in the end, very few people involved in the extracting and the harvesting reap any sort of benefits from the controlled economic development. And wages are only one matter. More important is the countrywide undesirability to invest in infrastructure and human resources, including education and healthcare. Two inarguably huge failures of the independence period in Central Asia, as wealth indeed is generated. Just not for most of the population. Lastly, today, I focus for a minute on the Western and more to the point, US role in this region. It hardly is the fault of the United States that Central Asians are unfree and suffer grossly from state repression. However, since 2001, the US has sent out strongly contradictory messages to Central Asian leaders. It is also true that a certain arrogance, Central Asians might argue, characterized the exuberance of many professional Westerners who visited Central Asia in the 1990s and worked to train and impart democratic and free market ideas and sensibilities to Central Asians. But in time, such cultural insensitivities probably would have been overcome. What happened after 2001, however, was qualitatively different. And I believe that the US not only damaged its own image in the eyes of millions of Central Asian people, but the US has also made it very difficult now to exercise positive influence over the Central Asian governments. Naturally, I am discussing the cooperation instituted in the pursuit of terrorists with Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and negotiations with the Turkmen. Once the US got Central Asian cooperation for its own military bases to resupply war efforts in Afghanistan, among other cooperative military ventures, to say nothing of allegations of rendition, the US basically looked the other way when it came to gross violations of human rights, anti-democratic policies, and the inability to attract foreign investment. Everything was sacrificed to pursue terrorists. One awful consequence of the past 7 years is that governments such as Uzbekistan's used its strategic partnership with the U.S. to treat its own religious population with impunity. There is no reason we could not have had a more restricted and critical relationship with Karimov, Akayev, and others, but the U.S. chose not to until the ghastly Andijan event. And by then, the response was critical, but late. In recent months, the U.S. once again is hoping that cooperation with the Uzbeks will lead to something mutually beneficial. And yet, condemnation of Karimov's authoritarian rule seems absent. For years, the Central Asian leaders have manipulated their relations with Western governments, Russia, China, and Korea, every bit as tactfully and skillfully as those countries have manipulated them, even as the Central Asians dealt from weaker positions militarily and economically. While it is impossible to say that things would have been much different if the US, Germany, or England, among others, had adopted more consistent freedom-promoting policies and diplomacy towards Central Asia, their relative lack of influence is clear in the short term. Now, no amount of Target not buying Uzbek cotton or the U.S. preventing Central Asian leaders from certain types of travel will alter Central Asian governments' determination to pursue policies that will continue to fail the poorest and working classes of their respective populations. For Central Asians themselves, they have taken the only alternative now feasible: immigrate or continue to languish. So the next major issue, of course, that people will start studying, they have already, is, of course, labor migration, both to Russia, Kazakhstan, other parts of the world. In the end, as scholars pursue more questions into the whys and hows of what I consider the failures of post-Soviet independence in Central Asia, they should balance their pursuit of logical models and comparative frameworks with the people who have to suffer, endure, and muddle through life saddled with these governments, and see them, in the words of Charles King, political scientist, as purposive suffering agents. I thank you for your attention today.